The Peace and Liberty Podcast, episode 10. Hey everyone, Stephen Clyde here. I'm going to waste no time at all and just say it's an absolute pleasure to have the chance today to talk to Dr. Mary Reward. If you don't know her, you'll never forget her because she approaches libertarianism from an interesting angle. In fact, we'll begin by talking about her first book titled Healing Our World, which many say was their introduction into libertarianism. But of course, we're ultimately here to discuss her new upcoming book titled Death by Regulation. And if that title alone doesn't make you want to buy it, know that if you pre-order right now, you will get a ton of bonuses. I already pre-ordered mine and I've been enjoying these bonuses. They include things such as a digital copy of Healing Our World, complimentary issues of Green Medicine Plus, which features Dr. Jonathan Wright, and other discounts such as $5 and $10 off coupons. So you won't want to miss the pre-order, and the book ships April 10th. Now, if you by any chance don't know Dr. Reward, she received her BS in biochemistry in 1970 and her PhD in biophysics in 1974, both from Michigan State University. She later joined the Department of Surgery at St. Louis University and left her assistant professorship there to accept a position with the Upjohn Company of Kalamazoo, and that was in Michigan in 1976. So as a research assistant, she was involved in developing new therapies for a variety of diseases. And this, of course, is why she's able to write so extensively on a topic such as the FDA, which is the main theme behind her new book, which again is titled Death by Regulation, How We Were Robbed of a Golden Age of Health and How We Can Reclaim It. And her bio just goes on and on and on. But I'll also mention that she ran as a candidate in the past for the Libertarian Party. So if we'll have time, we'll talk about that. But without further ado, Dr. Reward, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, it's great to be here.
I think it's pretty safe to say the world's ready for your new book, but before we get into that, and also I'm going to link to everything we mentioned today in the show notes page, you originally published Healing Our World back in 1992, and I noticed as I searched for the book and look at different editions that you would actually update the subtitle to something new with every edition. What was the reasoning behind the most recent subtitle of Healing Our World, which was The Compassion of Libertarianism, How to Enrich the Poor, Protect the Environment, Deter Crime, and Defuse Terrorism? Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, typically libertarians are considered selfish people who just want things for themselves. And what's wonderful in my mind about libertarianism is it doesn't even matter if a person who wants to practice it is, you know, selfish, unkind, because the principles themselves are compassionate. So as long as we are willing to stop aggressing against each other, even if we're not a particularly loving person, the result is going to be a wonderful compassion for the world in actual practice, because if we enrich the poor, protect the environment, you know, defuse terrorism, do all those wonderful things we all want, I mean, that's real compassion, not just words, but actions.
I totally agree. I mean, when you think about libertarianism, some people boil it down to Ayn Rand and being selfish, and it's like, no. So I guess I was going to ask, do you think this is the final subtitle? Because I love it.
Well, it probably will be, only because revising it has always been very difficult. And I think if I were going to do it again, I'd change the format. So yes, it probably is the last edition. And you know, I was brought into the movement by Ayn Rand too. And I read her material and I'm going, well, what she's saying about the non-aggression principle is right on. But this idea of being selfish is maybe not, you know, the full embodiment, shall we say, of that non-aggression principle. And so that's what I've tried to bring to the mix. I've tried to show the compassion of libertarianism, and it's wonderful.
Absolutely. I mean, Healing Our World, many people say it was their introduction into libertarianism, and that it really connects the dots for people. You come at it from an angle where, you know, libertarianism is compassion, and that compassion can only come under voluntary circumstances, and libertarians seek to live voluntarily. So there you go.
Yes, and if we truly want to love our neighbor, we have to practice the non-aggression principle with them. I mean, if I'm aggressing against you, I'm stealing your stuff, or I'm beating you up, or initiating force in any other way, I mean, that is not compassion. That is not love.
I have to agree. But let's get into your new book. You were on the Tom Woods Show, if I'm not mistaken, three different times. And I was listening to an episode you did with him, I think it was in 2015. And you were talking about a book you were writing that's, it sounded just like this one. Is that the same book? And how long has this been in the making? Wow.
Well, it took years. Well, I first started thinking about the concept of it in 2005, and I gave some, you know, talks about it, and people were so excited, they insisted I need to write a book. So that's kind of what happened. And like many of my books, it got much more involved than I thought it would. But it's very timely because obviously a lot of people are thinking about the problems with the FDA. You know, Congress has been thinking about passing Right to Try. It's been kind of ping-ponging around. But, you know, there's I think, an understanding now that the FDA holds life-saving drugs up because of the process that it has to go through. You know, if your listeners saw Dallas Buyers Club, they saw what happened to AIDS patients when we were researching to try to find new drugs. And sometimes the FDA didn't bother people who had AIDS and were actually making the same drugs that we were researching on. And when the FDA finally gave us permission to put them in people and test them, every AIDS patient in the country who wanted them already had them. And they were resistant, so we had to wait for new diagnoses. So I think that story, and there's many others like that, have really brought to the attention of the American public just how long it takes to get a new drug to market.
Yeah, that's actually one of my questions. But, you know, I love how you start off the book, by the way. And by the way, you gave me a sneak preview of the book, which I'm very thankful for, but I already pre-ordered mine. I suggest everybody pre-order yours, because also one thing I want to mention, I love the way you laid out the book. If I don't want to give too much away, but you laid it out in short chapters. So for example, you could pick up, read 5-10 minutes a day, and you got through one chapter, but you're reading it in short different paragraphs. So like I retain all the information I'm reading from it. So I love the way you laid it out, but you start off the book talking about thalidomide and thalidomide babies and how when you were growing up, this seemed like a plausible need for intervention. Can you tell us more about that? Because again, I love how you start off by kind of conceding that yes, to the reader, the intentions were good.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, the thalidomide tragedy happened mostly in Europe because the drug was not approved in the United States. Our regulations were enough to stop it here, probably for the wrong reason, but nevertheless, we didn't have it here. But in Europe, what was happening is it was put out as a safer sleeping drug. And it was probably safer than what was common back then, which was barbiturates. A lot of people were dying of overdoses. And then what happened is women realized that it helped the morning sickness of their pregnancy. So they started taking it, and then the company started advertising for it. You know, at that time, we didn't know, I shouldn't say we didn't know, but it wasn't widely appreciated, maybe is a better way to say it, that the fetus is much more sensitive to drugs than the mother is. So what happened is these babies were born without limbs. Some of them had larger defects and died. Some never really made it to delivery. So it was a very tragic thing.
And you said this was in Life magazine. These were pictures coming out in the media.
Oh, yes. I saw them and I was 10 or 12 at the time. And, you know, even at that early age, of course, I realized these children would, they would have a harder life, even though the age that they were showing them at, of course, they didn't realize it. They didn't realize they were different than other babies.
Wow. I mean, that does seem, you know, that is plausible to most people that we do need regulations to prevent some things. But you have a chapter titled, "Is Safe and Effective a Myth?" And I'm going to quote from the book here, but you're talking about how the FDA, they're really just a bunch of bullies. Listen here. "In dealing with FDA regulators, I usually found them to be sincere individuals who are trying to protect the American public. However, power corrupts and sets the stage for abuse. If an FDA examiner actively dislikes someone from industry, the review process is likely to go forward more slowly." Then you go on to say, "When pharmaceutical executives deal with the FDA, they have to tread carefully or risk, quite literally, years of retaliation." And you have a quote right after that from Peter Brimlow and Leslie Spencer that was from Forbes in 1933, quote, "84% of companies polled in 1991 reported declining to file a complaint against the FDA for fear of retaliation." Wow. This is what people have to go against.
Yes. And, you know, if you're an insider, you know this. And insiders don't speak about this because if they did, their company could be penalized. Of course, I'm not in the industry anymore, so I can speak out. But when I presented this work to a bunch of pharmaceutical scientists, they came up to me and said, "Oh, we are so glad someone's speaking out because we can't."
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just such an obstacle you have to climb over that we really kill people by effectively keeping drugs off the market, right? I mean, that's the way it seems.
Well, that's right. And these amendments to the Food and Drug Act that were passed in 1962 because of the thalidomide tragedy, they added almost a decade, 10 years, to the time that it takes a drug to get from the bench to the marketplace. I mean, people are literally dying waiting, and most people don't know that.
I think some people might have a clue, but at the same time, don't know how bad it is. They have no idea to the extent. And in fact, you mentioned 1962. This is perfect because you talk in another chapter about how regulations put small firms out of business. And you give a startling example, quoting again. Before 1963, the smallest firms required only 80% of the resources of large firms to produce the same amount of research and development. Large firms took about three times as long to develop drugs as those produced by small companies. So basically, the point is small companies were crushing the larger firms in this sector. But as early as 1966, amendment-related costs for large firms had increased 24%, but for small firms had increased 70%. So the small firms got crushed by these amendments.
That's right. That's right. And that's what happens. The larger firms, basically, they have an economy of size or scale, and so they can absorb these costs better than the small firms. It's devastating to the small firms.
Wow. I mean, I'm such a loss for words because, like, I understood this stuff to an extent, but this book is so needed right now because people need to know these real life examples. And I'm quoting from another chapter again. You talk about how, you know, this loss of innovation because a small sector gets crushed, it leads to higher cost. And without getting into specifics just yet, you point out something very interesting, and I never thought about it this way, because it relates back to the idea that healthcare nowadays, it's about how many times can you go see a doctor and get a checkup versus you talk about here, quoting again, for each dollar we spend on a new drug, we save about $3.65 on other types of healthcare costs, such as hospitalization. And you go on to say, when pharmaceutical treatments allow us to continue working or playing, instead of staying in bed while recovering for surgery, we save an addition of $1.11 that we could have otherwise lost. In other words, for every dollar we spend on drugs, we gain about $3.22 in benefits. Now, yes. I think the media narrative nowadays is exactly the opposite, that pharmaceutical companies are evil, we need less drugs, and we need more rules. So you're saying it's the exact opposite we need.
Well, yes, I should say, in fairness to the critics, I should say that in one sense they're correct in that what we've done, because of the added costs of the amendments, and it goes up every year, these amendments are still alive, they're metastasizing, the costs go up exponentially. And if you look at the cost of what we pay in the pharmacy for new drugs, it's directly correlated to what the companies need to pay to jump through the FDA hoops. So what's happening is because so few drugs recover their costs, only about 3 out of 10, and that's kind of a generous estimate, companies today won't develop anything unless you're going to take it for decades. I mean, they just can't afford to develop something you take for a month, you know, like antibiotics. It's very difficult. So they concentrate on these lifestyle drugs. And the problem with that is if you're taking a drug for a month, your body can handle it. If you take it for decades, your body starts having trouble and it gets depleted of the nutrients that it needs to, you know, detoxify these drugs. And then on top of that, more drugs are being prescribed than ever before. And so our bodies are suffering from that. So in some senses, the critics are right. But what they don't understand, and this is why I'm writing the book, is they don't understand that it's the amendments, the 1962 amendments that created this issue. And, you know, trying to come down on drug companies and lowering their prices or profits or whatever, it's only going to make innovation go down further. So we have to understand what the problem is. And I think, you know, we are, as libertarians and liberty-minded people, really in a good place to share that information because we understand how the market works. And the way the market's working is that if you interfere with it, then, you know, and try to put Band-Aids on it after that, things just go haywire.
You know, we went through these questions so fast, I thought it was going to take longer, but you answered so beautifully. I guess one question just off the top of my head, what was the crazy thing you think you saw? Because as I mentioned before, your career started in biophysics. I'm not that smart. What is biophysics and how does that relate to everything we're talking about now?
Well, back when I got the degree, what it meant is you took physical measurements of biological systems. Okay. So we were using things like, well, let's see, let me give it today's example. Everyone kind of knows what an MRI is today. So, you know, our CAT scan. So in other words, these are biophysical instruments and we're applying them to biology. So I had come in through the biochemistry. So I taught the physicists about biology and the physicists taught me about the physics. And so that worked out really well.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Well, again, I'm going to be linking to where you can pre-order the book. And just from the discussion, I'm super excited to read mine. I'm not going to read another word because I want to have the physical book and read it. But one last question I'll ask, and I don't know if I mentioned to you. In fact, I don't think I did mention to you. I don't know how I forgot that. This week for my podcast, the theme was women and libertarianism because I had a bunch of guests lined up. And it's like, oh, man, I could turn this into a theme. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest stereotypes right now is that libertarianism, if it's not white male, it's at least male dominated. So the question I would ask for you, and I asked this for all my guests, and they gave some pretty harsh and great responses. I loved it. But I would ask, what if someone said to you, libertarianism is male dominated, and therefore being a woman and a libertarian is an oxymoron?
Well, no, of course not. And obviously, Ayn Rand was a big contributor to the libertarian movement, even if she didn't quite believe in it at the time.
Right.
That just doesn't make sense. But what I think we've had a problem with in the libertarian movement is, and we don't appreciate how compassionate our philosophy is. We don't appreciate how it's connected to love. And we started talking about that earlier in the podcast.
Right.
And if you don't understand that connection, and I think most women, just because of the fact they're biologically built to bear children and raise them, I think maybe they have a little bit of an edge in the nurturing area, although I love to see that what's happening now, that the men are really getting involved.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least in my generation, let's say it that way, that wasn't necessarily true. So when a woman comes to the Libertarian Party and all she hears about is, you know, don't tread on me and, down with these government regulations and taxes, and no one's talking about a better way, which is what liberty brings. And many libertarians just don't have a good fix on that yet. I think it's discouraging. I think they come away with a sense that, you know, this isn't a nurturing philosophy. And it is. It's very nurturing. But one has to appreciate it.
I think in some sense, we kind of start to play into the caricature that our opponents present us as, you know, being selfish. So, yeah, I mean, my opponents say that, so I actually must be selfish. Well, not necessarily. We don't have to be caricatures of what our opponents say about us. But Dr. Rohr, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I'm going to link to everything, like I said. Go out and pre-order this book. It's going to be one of the biggest books coming out this year. I'd love to have you on again, actually, after the book releases, if that's okay, and we can discuss more chapters. So thank you so much for all you've done for the Ideas of Peace and Liberty, Dr. Rohr.
Well, and thank you for having me.
All right. Well, it's been a great week, and we'll do it all again starting Monday. As always, for Peace and Liberty, see you guys next week. Hey, everyone. Please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.